be humble as a Christian, what that means and that sort of thing. But the talks I've given the most often have to do with science and religion. You know, I'm a retired physics professor from Kent State University, and so people expect me to know something about science and religion, and anyway, I enjoy that. But so what I've given talks on before are like, why God? You know, why should we believe that the universe was created by a God, and why should we believe that there is a single God, and so forth? But you know, in the end, that's at most half of what we need, right? The other half is why Jesus, or why Christianity? Why should we believe that Jesus is the Son of God, and why should we be Christians in this day and age? And so that's what I'd like to address today, why Christianity? But I'm going to start by reviewing very briefly why should we believe in God, okay? And I have a longer PowerPoint presentation on this. If you're interested, you could give me your email address or something. I can give you one of the talks I've given before. But I'm going to review it very quickly today. So why Christianity? Okay, go ahead. Go to the next one. I gave this originally at our church in Ohio right around Christmas time. So I subtitled it, What Child Is This? And subtitle, How Shall We Escape If We Ignore So Great a Salvation? Come back to this, Hebrews 2:3. Okay, the next. So the talk I gave earlier was called The Marvelous and Mysterious Universe, or How to Talk with an Atheist. Okay, next slide. And the main points, and it really comes down to something very simple. You know, most things in the end really are simple. Einstein once said, if you can't explain something to your mother-in-law, you probably don't understand it. Okay, and some people will try to give you a whole bunch of complicated stuff and try to snow you with everything they know and everything, and therefore you ought to believe what they say because they obviously know so much. Well, it's not that way about almost anything. If somebody's talking to you about something, I don't care whether it's a car loan or Christianity, and they're making it very complicated, there's something wrong. There's something wrong. Okay, so the first basic question is, why is there something rather than nothing? I mean, that's the mystery of our existence in the universe and everything. Why are we here? Why is there something here rather than nothing? Where did all this come from? And of course, the real answer in the end is God. And we're still trying to understand his creation in all kinds of ways, and we're trying to understand his purpose for each one of us. But still, you can talk about all kinds of things having to do with religion and whether or not there's a God, but in the end, it'll just come down to that. And so there are all kinds of things we know now that we didn't know 100 years ago about physics and chemistry and so forth, but, you know, all those details don't matter in the end. It's just this basic question. Why is there something rather than nothing? The universe is a marvelous creation that we will never fully understand. We've learned a lot of things in the last 100 years, amazing things. And it's interesting, about 100 years ago, around 1900, scientists generally were convinced that we had everything all figured out. It seems impossible to believe in this day and age, because since then we've had relativity and quantum mechanics and all kinds of nuclear physics and all kinds of amazing things in biology and having to do with gene therapy and all kinds of things. But about 100 years ago, people thought they had it all figured out. They realized that the world was made of atoms, but the atoms interacted through the electromagnetic force, through electricity and magnetism, and you could describe the way different molecules and so forth formed together in terms of electromagnetic forces. And the electromagnetic force was figured out in the 1880s. And the way atoms interacted and everything, people thought it was all just some manifestation of the electromagnetic force. They had no clue about the nuclear force, for example. Well, then all kinds of things broke just after 1900, relativity, quantum mechanics, and so forth. And we realized we really didn't know that. We only knew a small fraction of what there was to know about the universe. Well, so then we got a little cocky again around 1980 or so, and we thought, all right, we know the nuclear force, and we know the basic forces, and we think we've got this pretty much figured out. And then along came dark matter and dark energy, and we still don't understand those. We don't know what dark matter is, and apparently there's more dark matter than there is normal matter that we can see. And then dark energy came along in the early 1990s, and we've now realized that about 3/4 of the total energy in the universe is in the form of dark energy. So you can say that before 1990, we only knew about 1/4 of the universe. Okay, and we still don't know what in the world dark energy is, and we can't describe it. So it's a mysterious universe. The universe is a marvelous creation that we will never fully understand. If you ever get to the point where you think you've understood it, well, God will probably drop something on you soon to make you realize you don't. God is also the most reasonable explanation, and we'll see why. We'll talk about that a little more. Next slide. Christian foundations of modern science. The early pioneers of modern science, 15th century all the way up until about 1900, were essentially all Christians. There are some contributions from Islam, mostly in the area of mathematics and astronomy and so forth, and we've picked up some things from Far Eastern influences and that, but most of what we call modern science was developed in Europe from around the 1400s until around 1900, and all those people were Christians. In some sense, you know, now most research is supported by the government, but all through the Dark Ages and up even through the Renaissance and so forth, it was all supported by the church. You know, now everybody wants to say the church is the enemy of science or something like that. It really was the church that supported the development of what we now call modern science. And if you look at the most notable physicists, say, of the 1800s that developed electricity and magnetism and so forth, they were basically all Christians and explicitly said that what they were doing is figuring out what God did. Okay, now since 1900, well, it's diverged. And now you have a number of scientists who claim to be atheists. I'm not sure anybody's really an atheist, but claim to be atheists. And now what you find in scientists is not that they're all atheists by any means. Don't let anybody tell you that. But it's about the same as the rest of society. Oh, somewhere between a third and half of scientists have strong religious beliefs and believe in God. At least that many, okay? All right, at any rate, they were guided by a faith that God is good and created an orderly, rational universe that can be comprehended at least in part. This is an amazing statement, actually. What it says is part of what we mean when we say God is good is that, you know, he didn't create some system here that's devious. That when we start to figure it out, well, he'll, you know, if you didn't step on this square, then you go back to the beginning again. It's a logical, orderly thing, and as you study the universe, you can begin to figure it out. You know, he has well-established laws that God has created and well-established principles and so forth, and we just slowly figure these out. It's really a marvelous creation, and it's orderly, and we can study it, and we can begin to learn things about it. That's part of its, quote, beauty. Okay, next slide. So what we've discovered more recently is that the universe appears to be tuned to a very, very high degree. And at first, scientists really rejected this. Oh, it began to appear this way in the 50s, in the 60s. And people said, no, when we just understand a bit more about what's really going on with nuclear force and the electromagnetic force and gravity and so forth and quantum mechanics, we'll see that it all had to be this way, that the universe had to be the way it is right now. Well, now even the scientists agree this universe is finely tuned. And as I'll discuss in a little bit, about the only reasonable explanation they have for it now is to say that there are multiple universes. There are an infinite number of universes being created and destroyed all the time, and only that one that has everything tuned just right will ever actually stick around and last for some time. Well, if this sounds crazy to you, it does also to most scientists. Okay. A lot of scientists are going in this direction, but a lot of them say, I don't know, I don't like that explanation. For one thing, we can never really prove it one way or the other. But at any rate, I don't want to go through these in detail. I have before, but there are all kinds of things like the strength and ratio of the fundamental forces, the exact masses of the proton, neutron, and all sorts of things that if they weren't exactly the way they are, the universe as we know it would disappear quickly. It would not exist. And again, at first scientists thought, no, it just can't be this way. But now they agreed. There are actual scientific papers in respected journals reviewed by peer scientists and so forth talking about the fine-tuning of the universe. Okay, next slide. And life itself appears to be unique. You know, well, heart, you know, okay. Used to be most people were my age or something like that. Now you're all younger than me, or most of you, not all of you, but at any rate, we can all some of us can remember when people said, okay, we're going to go into the laboratory and we're going to create life artificially. And people started doing that, in the 1940s even. And they got more serious about it in the 50s and the 60s, and they're still trying to do it. You know, so you take complicated hydrocarbon molecules that are not life, but are nice hydrocarbon molecules, and you put them in methane atmospheres, and you spark electricity through it, and you do everything you can think of. And you know what? They still can't produce life. You can't produce biological life from nothing. They're still trying to do it, and they can't do it. And scientists will seriously say things like, well, maybe life on Earth came here through a meteorite that had some spark of biological life in it. Well, where did that come from? You know? Any rate, life is not so easy. Biological life is not so easy. And if you look at, well, any rate, again, you need all these, just astrophysically, you need all these things in order to produce a planet like our Earth that could support life. And again, this appears to be very finely tuned. So some people will tell you, you hear this all the time, that there are people searching for Earth-like planets around other suns near us. And this is hard to do, but they find some that they think are possible candidates. And people would suggest that, you know, life is probable, and if it existed here, it's probably going to pop up in other places. Not so simple, not so easy. It could very well be that this is the only place in the universe that has life. And actually, if you really look at the numbers, that's what's most probable. Okay, and again, some scientists recognize this. Some say, well, there's something wrong with this argument. Life probably does exist other places. Okay, next slide. Biological life. Again, the simplest cell is already extremely complicated. If you see sort of a blow-up of the simple cell, it looks like a very complicated piece of machinery. It's just amazing what it is. And how you go from simple hydrocarbon molecules, well, it can even be fairly complex, but they're just things that don't work as any kind of machine, to all of a sudden something that has all kinds of interconnected parts in order to work. It's a mystery. It's a mystery. And this is why they haven't been able to do it in the laboratory, haven't been able to produce it. And then you get into questions about what do mutations really do? This whole business of evolution. Bottom line is, the hand of God is needed. Intelligent design. And again, many scientists believe in intelligent design. I don't know what fraction, at least a third, maybe a half. Okay? A lot of them don't. But don't let anybody tell you that scientists don't believe in intelligent design. It's a mystery. It's difficult. In fact, right now it appears to be impossible to produce life in the laboratory. Okay, next slide. So again, as I indicated a moment ago, so what a lot of people say is, well, in order to explain the universe that's finely tuned and life exists and everything is that maybe there are all these universes popping in and out of existence. Some people suggest that this is possible by the so-called uncertainty principle in quantum mechanics, but actually if you look at the numbers on it, it's very difficult for it to happen, to create something with this much energy out of the so-called vacuum. Well, I could talk about it. The so-called vacuum we think vacuum is where there's nothing, but even space that has nothing in it has certain properties about how fast light travels through it, what kinds of things can be created out of it, and so forth. Any rate, some people suggest that this could happen, but if there's another parallel universe somewhere, right now we have no idea how to possibly make contact with that to find out if it even exists. Okay, and it turns out that the kind of quantum fluctuation you'd have to have in order to create a universe with this amount of energy in it is just—it's essentially impossible. I mean, it's very, very improbable. And they want to have millions or trillions or infinite number of these happening all the time. This is a lame explanation, but it's what people are reduced down to if they don't want to say that, well, God did it, which is really the most reasonable explanation in the end, as I indicated. Okay, next slide. So I already went through some of these, and I could do this some more. Let's go on to the next slide. So, bottom line, why God? Well, everything seems to exist for a reason. You know, that's what you notice. The sun shines and plants grow and everything, and we figure out photosynthesis, whatever, and almost everything we see around us we can understand. You know, in an automobile collision, they hit this way and they go off that way. You can do the kinematics of it and figure out why the car skidded off that way and everything. There seems to be an explanation for everything. And so what are you going to do? You're going to come down and finally you're going to say, well, the universe, though, just exists. It just is for no reason. I mean, actually, this is the most impossible thing for me to think about. I don't know what that means. It just is. It just is, you know. Everything seems to have a reason. And if there isn't a reason for all this, then, you know, as they say, it's a, as Shakespeare said, what is it? It's a farce or something that we're all just playing, and it really makes no sense, you know, and we might as well just go out and party or something. You know, has to be a reason for all this, ultimately. We don't know what those reasons are. I mean, we know it's God. As Christians, we know it's God, but we don't understand God fully. But there has to be a reason for all this. It just, that's the basic thing that I think is, you know, there's this hole in all of us that has to believe there really is a reason why this universe is here. There's a reason why I am here. There's a reason why these things happen, even though I don't understand. God is the reason the universe exists. And God is good and his universe is good in all kinds of ways, but some of the ways I just indicated. That is, he gave us a universe we can study. All right, let's go on. But why Jesus? Okay. So that was just my introduction. I'm sorry. I'll get through this. It won't take that long. But why Jesus? Next slide. Why should we believe Jesus is the Son of God and follow him? Next slide. Why not choose Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, or atheism? Well, atheism, I'm more or less addressed with what I just talked about. The only way you can explain what's here is some kind of supernatural touch had to do it. Nothing else really works. That something exists instead of nothing. Okay, but why not choose Islam, Buddhism, or Hinduism? All right, next slide. This is the basic outline. It feels right, Christ is beautiful, the evidence for the risen Christ is strong, and knock and he will answer. That is, ask God to reveal it to you. You know, the word says knock and he will answer. Okay, it feels right. Let's start into this then. Next slide. The teachings of Jesus just feel right. Go ahead, next slide. Love one another. So I'm going to go through some basic tenets of Christianity, and my thesis here is going to be that the more you think about Christianity, the more you realize this is just right. This is the way it should be. And I'll compare it with some of the other major religions of the world and what they have to say about some of these things. Now, some of the things in Christianity can be a little difficult, but we know they're right, like love your enemy. I'm not saying, you know, we all are nuts about this, but you know, somewhere down inside, you know that's right. You know it's right. Okay, love one another. Well, a number of religions require that, but that's certainly one of the major tenets of Christianity. Next slide. Love your enemy, as I just said. Again, we'll get to it, but you take something like Islam, you know, if they won't convert, you might as well kill them. You know that's not right. You don't, this doesn't take rocket scientists or something, you know. Love your enemy. Again, it's hard, can be hard in certain situations, just, it doesn't have to be some dramatic enemy like that, somebody who just opposes you in the workplace or in your family or something like that. But love your enemy. But we know it's right. We know it's right. And not that many other religions tell us to do this. Next one. Forgive those who sin against you. Same sort of thing. How many times should we forgive somebody who sins against us? But again, we know it's right. This is really the way it has to be. What happens if you don't do this? Well, you start feuds, the Martins and the McCoys or whatever, and it goes on and on and on. Somebody's got to break it at some point. Forgive those who sin against you. Even Judaism, it's still an eye for an eye. You know, and Islam is an eye for an eye. And as long as you do that sort of thing, it's the fighting is not going to stop. It's not going to stop, and you know that. Now, when somebody sins against you, your first reaction is not to forgive them. Okay? But down deep, you know that's where you got to get. That's where you got to get. It doesn't mean you don't do certain things to protect yourself and your family or whatever, but you realize you need to be praying for these people somehow or another. Okay, next one. Be a servant. And Christ came and says he was a servant. He was a servant above everything else, and he says we should be like him. What we should strive to do is to serve others, to help others, and so forth. Again, a lot of religions don't make this one of the major tenets, that what we really should do is be somebody who serves everybody else as much as possible. Okay? But again, you know it's right. You know it's right. Next one. Be righteous. Well, a number of religions, I'll go through them just a little bit, teach something along this line, be righteous. But we know this is also correct. We should do this. But one of the real differences we have with a number of religions is some of them believe that you need to just keep getting to be more and more righteous, and eventually you'll get righteous enough that somehow you'll be able to remove yourself from all trouble and so forth because you're so righteous. Do you think that works? I mean, what Christianity teaches is that we're all sinners. It's not that we can't get better. We can get better with God's help, and we can stop sinning in certain chronic ways that we often do. But is there anybody you know that never does anything wrong? Okay, any rate, next one. Be merciful. You know, the Beatitudes. Well, those are, you know, you go through the Sermon on the Mount, and that's what the scriptures are for Lent for this year that we're reading in the morning that were sent around from the ministers of York County. Most people, a lot of people in the world read the Beatitudes and say, this is just silliness. This is ridiculousness. It doesn't work this way. But the more you look at them, again, the more you realize this is right. And it's basically this sort of thing. It's this sort of thing. This is what we should be. So I maintain that as you think about it, honestly, Christianity feels right. I've always been impressed with this. You know, the more I get to know Christianity, I don't come to something where, quote, I get a check in my spirit that says, wait a minute, I don't think this is what the God of the universe would want me to be doing. Just the opposite. Okay, next slide. Christianity. Okay, Christianity also, I maintain, has the right balance between the physical world and the spiritual world. Next slide. I think we go into detail. You know, so it says, render under Caesar what is Caesar's. You know, next slide. Obey authority, Romans 13:1. Okay, so we're in the world, and we need to get along with it. I mean, we go out, we drive down the right side of the road in this country, and we stop at stop signs, usually, and so forth. We need to do these things. We need to live in this world. But next slide. But at the same time, it says, do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So Christianity recognizes we're in this world, and we need to live in this world, and we need to deal with this world. It's not an illusion. It's not something that doesn't really exist. It's real. But at the same time, we shouldn't be controlled by it. We should be able to rise above it in a sense. Not that we can get outside it while we're alive, but that we need to find ways to not let it pull us down into things that will, you know, really hurt us in the end. Okay, again, this is the right kind of balance, and we'll contrast this here briefly. Okay, next slide. So the Christian life, you know, it says, lead a spirit-filled life full of prayer and obedience to God. And we live this life in the world as a witness to Christ and his love. So there's this balance all the time. We should be in prayer. We should be asking the Holy Spirit to direct us. What do we do today? What should I do about this argument I'm having with this friend of mine? Should I agree with him? Should I try to convince him he's wrong, I'm right? Whatever, we go to the Holy Spirit, we go to the Lord, and we ask for help and everything. But we are living in this world, and we hopefully can do it as a witness to Christ and his love. Okay, next slide. So what about other religions? Let's contrast these things, which I maintain, the more you think about them, or you don't even have to think about most of them very long, you just know are right. These are correct. Islam. You know, there's this thing today where we're supposed to allow everybody to do their thing. Okay, you know, we shouldn't come down on our Muslim brothers and so forth. We should allow them to do their thing, and we'll do our thing, and everybody will be happy. Okay. Well, I'll go through this in just a little bit of detail. I'll give you a personal story of a friend of mine who's Muslim. But you know, there's some things in this world that are right and some things that are wrong. And if you look at Islam, Islam was basically created by Muhammad, although there's been some talk lately that a lot of what's in the Quran he borrowed from something that was written even hundreds of years earlier. But at any rate, the modern form of Islam that we know is based on the Quran, which was put together by Muhammad, and Muhammad was a warrior. And Muhammad started Islam by conquering the neighboring cities and tribes and stuff around where he was. And he built into this, quote, religion from the beginning that if these people don't want to convert, then just go ahead and wipe them out. There are a lot of things in the Quran, you know, there's a lot of things that are good and say things about, well, you should be good to other people and so forth. But ultimately, you have to look at the source of this. Where did it come from? You know, where did Christianity came from? Came from a guy who more than anything else wanted to be a servant. And he was, quote, lowly. He was of no great prestige in his time. Okay, well, he was welcomed into Jerusalem as a king, but it didn't take long and people turned on him about that, led by the authorities. But at any rate, he wasn't some powerful ruler and he wasn't a warrior or anything like that. He was a servant. And he says we should be like him. The guy who started Islam was a warrior. And that whole religion, I'm sorry, was based on this. And they continue to fight today. Not that Christians don't fight. They do. But it's not because they're following Jesus when they do that. Okay? Whereas in Islam, it can be. You know, one form of Islam says those guys got it wrong, so you might as well wipe them out. Again, I don't think you have to think about this very long, and you just know somewhere, wait a minute, this is not right. It's just not right. It's too oppressive, still an eye for an eye, and so forth. Okay, my personal anecdote. So we had a graduate student in our group back in the 1980s, and he was from Egypt, and he was a very devout Muslim. And he's just one of the nicest guys I've ever met. I mean, this guy literally wouldn't hurt a fly. He was a good heavyset guy, and he was a good scientist. He's now on the faculty at Southern University in New Orleans. And I think for a while he was chair of the department there. He's a very good guy, very good physicist. And about the time he was a graduate student in our group, this whole business with Salman Rushdie came out. Again, some of you aren't old enough to remember this, but Salman Rushdie published this book called The Satanic Verses. And a number of Muslims around the world said, this is apostasy, and this guy needs to be removed. He needs to be wiped out, you know. And a lot of formal imams and so forth said this, okay. And so this was happening about this time. And so I asked this friend of mine, Mustafa was his name, Mustafa El-Azhar. I said, well, do you think this is right? You know, do you think Salman Rushdie should be killed? Well, he probably wouldn't step on a fly. He'd say, well, what he did wasn't good. He shouldn't have done that. And I said, no, but do you think he should be killed for that? No, well, you know, that was a very bad thing for him to do. And you could push him and push him and push him, and he would never say, yes, he should be killed. But all he would keep saying was, you know, that was a very terrible thing for him to do. I mean, somewhere inside him, he knew that that wasn't really right. You shouldn't do that. But he was defending his faith. I mean, he'd grown up with it, you know. His whole family was this, and he was a really nice guy. So what's the point? Point is, you know, it's this, as we say, you should hate the sin but love the sinner. Some of these Muslims are really actually very good people. In fact, probably most of them are pretty good people. And we need to love them, and we need to pray for them, and so forth, and we need to try and help them. And we don't run out and immediately confront them all and say, hey, you know, you've got the wrong religion, you know, you're out of it, you know. We start by trying to become their friends and learn who they are and hopefully live a Christian life in front of them and take the opportunity when we can to introduce them to the true Son of God, the guy who came and was a servant rather than a warrior. Okay, next one. Hinduism. Well, almost literally, this is a many-headed monster. They have many gods. Some of them do. But at any rate, I went to India 5 or 6 years ago with our pastor from Ohio. And we went to some Christian orphanages, and we went to some Christian churches there, and we did some teaching and saw a number of people and did some witnessing and so forth. But as you drive around in India, every little village you come into, you see 1, 2, 3 shrines somewhere or another. And some of them will be this a snake god, and some of them will be an elephant god, okay, or a cow god or something like that. Many villages have more than one, but they all have at least one. Often a certain village, you know, they believe that this particular god is the one that really controls their village or has to do with their village, and they should pray to. And so there are many gods. There are many gods in Hinduism. Now, there are some, quote, modern people, well-educated people, who are Hindus who, quote, rise above this. And they won't necessarily deny that there can't be all these other lesser gods, but they will maintain that there may ultimately be one superior god. We have a friend in Ohio that we often have dinner with and so forth, who considers himself more or less a priest in Hinduism. Okay, and he doesn't believe in snake gods and elephant gods and so forth particularly. And he's written a number of books on this, and they're very practical about how you should lead your life, having to do with economics and all kinds of things. And he's in contact with certain priests from India and so forth who espouse this sort of thing. Okay. But they still, it's a multiple thing, you know. There may be a head chief god somewhere, but there are also all these lesser gods. And what they basically believe, though, is that a fundamental problem that comes up in most religions, including Christianity and Hinduism and Buddhism, is what about the whole business of suffering? Or some people say the problem of evil, okay? And what are you going to do about that? Well, in Hinduism, what they basically believe is that we all suffer because of what ancestors of ours did in generations before us. And the more righteous we live, the more correct we live for the kind of way we were born and what we were born into and everything, can make things better for people to come after us. And somebody, even if they really live righteously enough and do the right kinds of things and have the right kind of thinking, can actually rise above all this. Well, again, I challenge you. Do you know one person who's been able to do this? One person who, just by living righteously enough, is able to remove themselves and get above all suffering? Okay? We're back to this right balance between the physical world and the spiritual world. It just doesn't quite hold up. It doesn't hold water in the end. And it leads to, it supports the caste system, which is still strong in India. They're trying to do things about it, but it's still inherent in the religion. So if you meet a Hinduism and he doesn't believe in all kinds of funny gods and everything, well, there are people like that, and people that we know here in the United States may be more along that line sort of thing, but it's all part of the basic religion. But they still have this basic belief that somehow you got to do more correct thinking and more correct behaving, and somehow that'll lead you to a better life. And what's really missing is this grace of God business. You know, we're all sinners, and the only way we can do something about that in the end is just ask God through Jesus to forgive us for it. We can't fix it by being more righteous, by living better. There are lots of good reasons for doing that, and we should all strive to be more righteous, but it isn't going to cure it completely. Okay, next one. Buddhism. Well, Buddha was a guy who lived around 500 BC, and he grew up as a prince in a very wealthy family or something like that. And sometime when he was around 20 years old, he actually left the palace grounds for the first time. And he led a very pampered life and had everything he wanted and all that. This was in northern India, or actually in Nepal, I think. He went outside the palace grounds and he discovered there are all these people out here who are really suffering. Have all kinds of problems. A lot of them are hungry and poor and don't have things and so forth, and didn't have the luxurious lifestyle he had. And he became obsessed with this whole business of suffering in the world. And he went through a number of things. After a bit, he became an ascetic. That is, you just go off and you pray and everything, and somehow you could rise above this. You reject the physical world, and somehow you can get above this. But then in the end, he came back to something more in between, which has become known as the Eightfold Way, where there's a certain amount of this asceticism where you just pray and try to rise above it all, but you also try to walk righteously and so forth. And so it's a bit like Hinduism. That is, if you behave more righteously, if you think more righteously and so forth, you can get to the point where somehow you'll rise above suffering. You know, again, my basic response to that is lots of luck. You know, it just doesn't work in the end. It just doesn't work. Suffering is real. Suffering is there. Okay? And we just need God's help with it all. And there isn't something we can do that's a magic formula that'll allow us to rise above it, except for to ask for God's grace. Ask for God's grace with respect to it all, including our sinning. Okay, but now there's Zen Buddhism and other things. People have taken things off from this and gone in different directions, and some of them are very aesthetic and some of them aren't and so forth. But again, the basic idea is by righteous living, righteous thinking, somehow we can rise above the problems of the physical world. You know it's not right. It doesn't work. We're stuck with this world whether we want it or not. Okay, although it's good. So I argue. Okay, I'm almost done. Next one. So we're back to Christianity. In Christianity, Jesus is beautiful. He showed mercy. You know, woman's about to be stoned. He showed compassion when a good friend of his died. She then rose from the dead, but he wept. He showed compassion. And this is God. This is our God, the God of Christianity. Showed healing, the blind, the leper, etc. At one point in the New Testament it says Jesus healed them all. Everybody who came to him for healing of whatever kind, he healed them. That's what our God wants to do. And he showed deliverance like the demoniac. Showed power, calmed the storm. This is our God. This is the God of the universe. The mysterious God who's created this universe that we slowly understand physically a little more and a little more, but we'll never fully understand. And most important of all, he showed love. Showed love. He died for us all. Okay? So he's a servant. And he's a guy who taught us we're in this world and we need to live in this world, but we need to in some ways rise above it. But you never get to that point where you're not still in the world until you die and go to heaven. Okay? Maybe one more slide. Well, no, maybe a couple. The evidence for the risen Christ is strong. Why Christianity? Crucifixion is predicted in the Old Testament. Number of scriptures, and this is about 30 of them. You can do studies on these, of course, and probably a number of you have. The risen Christ was seen by Mary Magdalene, the apostles, and to more than 500 others. And if you want to maintain that, well, you know, these are all written by people who were believers or whatever, anything, just look at the lives of the apostles after his death and the resurrection. I mean, some of these people, like Peter, denied him 3 times on the night he died, on the day he was sentenced, then lived a life where, you know, finally he was, crucified or died a violent death and so forth. Where did they get this from? They got it because they saw the risen Christ. They saw the risen Christ, and it just completely turned them around. And we can still see the risen Christ in our own way. And most of us have an experience we can talk about, our salvation experience, where we know that Jesus is alive. Okay, next one. And so that comes to this. Knock and he will answer. If you want to know, is this true or not? What you have to do is you just have to get to the point where you have to be honestly willing to ask God, is Jesus your son? Is Jesus alive now? Is he part of the God? Is Jesus God? And if you honestly, earnestly will knock and ask God for this, he will answer. He will let you know. I could give you my testimony, which I'm not going to do right now, but that's basically what he did for me when I was 40-some years old, when I was 44 years old. I'd been raised in the church and everything. I'm not going to give the whole testimony, but I was raised in the church and then kind of wandered out, you know, asking as a scientist, is all this real and everything? But I was continually knocking. And finally, supernaturally, it was revealed to me that Jesus is alive. Jesus is alive. And I knew that more than I knew anything. My own name or whatever, I knew that Jesus was alive. If you will honestly, earnestly seek him, he will reveal himself to you supernaturally, and you can know. So now I think, last slide maybe. So how shall we escape if we ignore so great a salvation? Okay, go ahead. Answer, we cannot. Jesus is beautiful. Jesus is the Son of God. Jesus is the way. Jesus loves us and gave his life for us. Okay.